From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The leadership of many progressive movements for justice over the past several years has been dominated by Indigenous activists, from the Standing Rock confrontation over the Dakota Access Pipeline to climate justice marches at the United Nations and the movement to protect Bears Ears National Monument in Utah, to name a few. But that is no coincidence, given the hard work being done within Indigenous communities for years that often goes unreported and that has laid the groundwork for high-profile actions. Now, one academic who has studied Indigenous movements for years and has hosted a radio show featuring many Native leaders has compiled a book exploring their powerful activism. J. Kehaulani Kawanui is a professor of American Studies and Anthropology, director of the Center for the Americas, and chair of the American Studies Department at Wesleyan University. She's the editor of the new book, Speaking of Indigenous Politics, Conversations with Activists, Scholars, and Tribal Leaders. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. Mahalo, Sonali. It's good to be on your program.
Thank you so much for joining us. You and I had spoken years ago about a struggle of Indigenous Hawaiians around sovereignty rights and the issue of Indigenous communities. Whenever we talk about Indigenous communities, there's a huge diversity, right? Both ethnically, geographically, when we talk about the origins. When you write Indigenous politics, how do you define Indigenous? Because I noticed that in your book, you've included Palestinians.
Yes, it's an expansive definition for indigeneity in terms of how I identify Indigenous politics. And indeed, when I produced and hosted the show from 2007 to 2013, it wasn't so common to see Palestine included in conversations about the Indigenous world. But we know that indigeneity is a political category, and most Indigenous peoples are subject to forms of settler colonialism, that is a structural genocide that is in the service of the settler community that aims to eliminate them from the lands that they dominate, meaning the settler community wants to dominate lands that actually already have inhabitants. And so actually when I first started producing the show, and I talk about this a bit in the critical introduction to the edited book, I had to actually define for a listenership what I meant by Indigenous peoples. So for starters, you know, we would include Native Americans, Native Alaskans, Native Hawaiians, Chamorros from Guam, one of the occupied Pacific Islands, including the Northern Mariana Islands. And then from there, we can think about Indigenous peoples in Australia, the Maori nations or Iwi in New Zealand, also known as Aotearoa, First Nations, Métis, and Inupiat communities encompassed by Canada, Ainu subject to Japan, Sami land throughout all of Scandinavia, and so on. And so in relation to including Palestine, I really was committed to having that conversation and thinking about the comparative pieces in relation to U.S. settler colonialism and the Israeli settler colonial project vis-a-vis Indigenous peoples in both sites. Some people would say, oh, indigeneity is not done the same way in Palestine as it is in North America. And I would say that's right. Neither is it the same in terms of defined locally in Hawaii, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't actually serve us as an analytical and political category in terms of political subjugation.
So when you have this great diversity, do you essentially say that Indigenous communities are the original settlers of the land, the original human settlers of the land on which they still reside? Or is that too simplistic?
I take your point in terms of thinking about it as being there prior, but I wouldn't use settler to actually talk about Indigenous peoples ever. And that has to do with being attentive to the way that Indigenous peoples across the globe have their own origin stories of how they got to those lands, how they became part of those lands, how they're related to those lands. And for example, when people talk about Hawaiians migrating to the Hawaiian Islands or Polynesians migrating to the Hawaiian Islands, that's an archaeological framework that's within a specific sort of scientific epistemological frame that differs from, say, Hawaiian accounts or genealogical accounts of the making of the islands themselves in relation to our own origin stories. And I'll say plural because there's not always just one. And so I wouldn't want to ever say settlers in the same way that I wouldn't say, you know, how Indigenous peoples colonized certain lands when people use colonized to simply mean populate, because colonized has such a heavy weight of meaning in terms of political connotations historically around, you know, non-consensual domination and subordination and racism and violence.
And so language is absolutely critical. I take your point, absolutely. So when you were putting this book together, did you find that the definitions were really critical, not just of what Indigenous is, but also of how various communities saw their struggle vis-a-vis the what they were facing, the opposition that they might have been facing, or what they might be fighting for or fighting against, that these definitions and the language that they use is so critical, because there's also an tendency, I think, from non-Indigenous communities to romanticize Indigenous communities, isn't there?
Yes, that's absolutely the case, especially in the U.S. in terms of thinking of the dominant white settler hegemonic notion of what constitutes an American Indian. I mean, the language gets really tricky. I mean, people will say Native American here in the U.S., for example, and yet nation by nation, people often identify by their tribal affiliation. So Navajo Nation or Diné or Native Hawaiian or Kanaka Maoli, or somebody might say Standing Rock Sioux, as part of the broader Lakota Nation. And yet Indian still has an internal, it still circulates as an internal term, whereas that doesn't fly in the same way, say, in Canada. First Nations is more common, and even Native can be seen as derogatory. And so it really is specific to location, and often that those differences are forged also through the colonial legacy. So for example, to say Indio, which is the Spanish term for Indian, south of the U.S.-Mexico border, is really, it's like a fighting word. It's really understood as an epithet. And yet, you know, somebody might say casually, you know, he's an Indian, meaning an American Indian. It doesn't quite carry the same weight. I mean, obviously that's context specific, but as a general rule, or general kind of rule of thumb, I should say, not a rule. And so that really varied. And thinking about that in relation to the topics covered on the radio program itself and also the edited book, I should note for listeners and viewers that in those 7 years that I produced the show, there were over 200 people featured on the program. Most were interviewed, and in some cases I aired lectures or public talks. But out of that run, I selected 27 people to be featured in this book in interviews that really say something about what's going on in this present moment. So for example, the interview with Margot Tamez, I've included two of them because I did follow-ups on the show, provide a perspective on Lipan Apache women's resistance to the U.S.-Mexico border wall. Certainly that issue has only intensified under the Trump administration. So for example, the interview that I did with Margot Tamez, both of them back to back, serve as a critical genealogy for issues going on right now. That would look really different than the interview with Hone Harawira, who's a longtime Maori activist in Aotearoa, New Zealand, whose interview was really about his founding or co-founding of the Maori Party and thinking about, you know, the British colonial legacy in New Zealand and parliamentary politics, and Maori activists who have been identified for long histories as radical, actually fighting for some sort of mainstream political representation. So those are just two examples. I can give you a third. I have two follow-up interviews with Chief Richard Velke from Shkatakok Nation, encompassed here by the Connecticut state borders, and the struggle of that tribe for federal recognition, when they're actually one of the earliest tribes that had a reservation carved out by the English. And you have this long legacy of recognition from the Connecticut colony and the early Connecticut state, and yet they still don't have federal recognition. And what does that battle look like here with state officials actually opposing their federal recognition bid, whereas in Hawaii, state officials were trying to actually impose a federal recognition model on Hawaiian people, that is to say the policy, U.S. federal policy on tribal nations on the Hawaiian case, when Hawaiians have a really robust claim to independence under international law because of the illegal overthrow of the U.S. occupying the Hawaiian kingdom. So just in those four examples, you can see like massive diversity and all the kinds of issues that come with that in terms of talking about them in the language, being attentive to legal issues And my aim was really to unpack some of those complicated stories for a general listening audience and now for our general readership.
In terms of a common thread between and through all of these stories and these struggles, would you say that one important common struggle is a struggle for preservation of tradition, language, religion, the stories and the often oral histories that Indigenous communities have used to pass on their traditions to future generations?
Preservation is a huge issue in terms of cultural continuities and Indigenous futures and survivance, as Gerald Visner would put it, right? That link between resistance and survival. I would say, working with the idea of preservation often connotes, even unintentionally, keeping things in the past or keeping them as is, instead of understanding that Indigenous peoples are alive and thriving and resisting all the time. And so, like all people's traditions, traditions change with Indigenous innovation, and also what it means to be structurally confined politically in these structures of domination and violence and still be able to assert that Indigenous agency. So I'd say that if I had to pick one theme, if I can fudge it a little bit and say maybe a three-prong theme, it would be really highlighting and lifting up Indigenous agency in the service of Indigenous sovereignty and self-governance. And that really what the interviews in the program and Indigenous people and peoples, that is people as individuals and peoples as collective polities do, is the work of anti-normalization. That is to push back on the narratives that would say that Indigenous peoples no longer exist or that they're headed always already for extinction and or always already inauthentic because they don't have the same pre-colonial culture, without recognition of what it means to survive the onslaught of that violence and still come out, fighting.
Now, in the past decade or so, there has been some really interesting progress, globally speaking, through the United Nations in particular, for Indigenous communities and nations throughout the world to gain recognition, to gain rights, to articulate rights. And it's been, I understand, quite an important Indigenous-led process. We don't hear much about that in the United States, and we don't couch the politics of Indigenous communities in the United States within that global framework. But how important is it for us to understand that this is a global issue?
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you brought that up. And I mean, this is the work of anti-normalization, right? To actually make that visible like you just did. And I think this also tells people something about the importance of independent media, such as your own program and the work that the radio show was doing, is that we're not seeing this in corporate media and we're not seeing this in public media. And so that's absolutely true. In terms of the global issue, we know that the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which the General Assembly voted on and passed in September 2007, which was actually the same year that the radio show launched, really was a game changer in many ways in terms of political mobilization around the globe. Now, I don't want to make it sound like it started at that point. Obviously, there were decades of work by Indigenous individuals and allies and all the kind of work that people did as communities to actually draft that declaration. And it was an embattled process. There are Indigenous activists who were part of that can speak to that very directly. But my understanding really has to do with that draft language of talking about Indigenous peoples, number one, qualifying as peoples under international law. Because when you say peoples, again, that's the collective rights. It's not people as an individual, or one might say the Hawaiian people as one people. But peoples connotes nations. Peoples connotes polities. And a lot of countries did not want the S added to the end of that peoples in the actual name of the declaration. So, for example, some of your listeners and viewers might know or remember hearing about this in 2007. There were only four independent states across the globe that voted against the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples: Canada, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand.
Wow.
All Anglo settler societies with visible and prominent Indigenous communities. And even when they were having the discussion, say, with the U.S. State Department rep, to even talk about the draft declaration before it passed, they would use the term Indigenous peoples with an asterisk and have a footnote at the bottom saying, by peoples, we don't mean peoples in terms of what that term connotes under international law. And mind you, Sonali, the declaration is not even an international convention. So in and of itself, it is not even an international law. It's an aspirational document That doesn't mean that it's not important. We talk about the Declaration on Human Rights, and you work it enough, it becomes customary law, right? And so people have mobilized around the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But even with those four countries voting against it, it did pass. However, anybody who's read it, and I encourage people to look it up online and take a look if they're interested, you'll see at the beginning there's a statement that said Indigenous peoples have the right to full self-determination. And that is in the beginning, which actually qualifies Indigenous peoples in line with the United Nations Charter, the founding document that says all peoples have the right to self-determination. And by virtue of that right, they should be able to freely determine their political status. But when you get to the bottom of the UN Declaration on the rights of Indigenous peoples, there at the very end says, Indigenous peoples' self-determination is only allowed insofar as that it doesn't threaten the political or territorial integrity of the existing states that currently encompass them.
So it's okay for Indigenous peoples to ask for their rights, except when it impacts the powerful elites.
Well, but also, you know, it shows you that international law still keeps has the status of states above peoples.
Right.
And it is what you say as well, but also it's internally contradictory. At the beginning of the Declaration, it says Indigenous peoples have the right to full self-determination. But by the end of it, it says, so long as it doesn't threaten the political or territorial integrity of the existing states, which is, again, about political subordination. So even within an aspirational document that has a lot to say on free and informed prior consent, that Indigenous peoples should be consulted whenever corporations and governments want to go in and extract from their lands, for example. Those are all important, and I don't want to diminish those or all the decades of work, but that even something that has this internal contradiction that undercuts the actual rights of Indigenous peoples was still seen as a threat to these four nations that voted against it. Now, when those conservative administrations in each of those four cases, you know, were elected out of office, you did have the subsequent administrations endorse the Declaration, and people are still really working to mobilize and use the Declaration in terms of customary practice. And so, you know, time will tell how it actually gets used more and more across the globe. But this is to say that 2007 was a watershed moment. It also intersects with when the show went on air, and there were other global developments that happened at the time, including the forming of the Maori political party I mentioned. That's when you had Bolivia actually codify Indigenous peoples' rights in a newly revised constitution. That's when, in the scholarly world, we had the founding of the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, which is a global Indigenous Studies Association founded in 2008. I was part of that as one of the original six co-founders. And so the span of the show coincided with all these developments across the globe. And that's another exciting part of it, and also played a role in terms of how I selected the interviews to include in the book.
I'm wondering how common a thread through all of these communities the issue of climate is, another big global existential issue. Here in the United States, as I mentioned, Native communities, Indigenous communities have been on the front lines lately, especially in the last many years of battles that have been playing out. And across the world, especially island nations with the strong Indigenous movements and communities face the threat of extinction. I imagine that may not be as big an issue, say, in Palestine, where they're dealing with the Israeli state and oppression from the Israeli state. But is climate a relatively common thread that you find in terms of what concerns a lot of these communities?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the Pacific Islands, certainly, including one of the shows. This isn't an interview included in the book, but one of the programs that I did towards the end run of the program was actually focused on Pacific Island people at the United Nations, doing the work with the Pacific Caucus, and everything was really highlighted was about climate change. Although I will note that since 2013, you have way more visibility around Indigenous peoples articulating that. And I think Keystone XL, at least the early iteration of it, right, we're seeing a whole now new iteration of Keystone XL with Trump declaring that he wants to move ahead on it. But I think so much of the watershed moment was that Indigenous individuals and leaders really took the lead on Keystone XL and really educated non-Native or non-Indigenous allies to say that you can't separate colonialism from climate change, so we can talk about colonial climate change. And I think that really kind of broke things open so that when you saw the pushback against the Dakota Access Pipeline, for example, led by the Lakota people in Standing Rock Sioux, you saw people and allies and people in solidarity with the Native Nation actually talk about these as related, so that we no longer can, you know, that environmentalists, for example, can no longer get away with talking about extractive economic plunder without talking about it in relation to colonialism and violent domination that is genocidal. I mean, if you really destroy the aquifer underneath people's traditional land, and they have to move to survive and leave that last part of, say, their reservation that was carved out of a much, much broader, beautiful homeland. What's not genocidal about that, right? Part of that distinctiveness of Indigenous peoples is to be able to live on traditional homelands.
Now, we recently had midterm elections here in the United States, and the first two Native American women to ever win election to Congress, Charisse Davids and Deb Haaland, they broke this record, which is just kind of insane to think about that in the year 2018, that it's taken this long for Congress to have even a single Native American woman. We now have two all at once. We went from zero to two. Do you see their election wins as a victory in the spectrum of struggles and fights that Indigenous communities are waging? Or does that sort of fall outside, because they ran for and won elections within the context of the U.S. federal government?
Right. That's a great question. I have a critical take in terms of U.S. electoral politics, but I don't want to set up a binary in terms of it being a federal issue or not. And part of that has to do with the fact that Native Americans, the U.S. imposed citizenship unilaterally on American Indians, and American Indians historically through the 20th century, and there's some incredible scholarly work by Native scholars that have looked at this, to talk about it not being a binary between being seen as American and being seen as of one's own Native nation. And part of that has to do with those structural confines and how Native American or Indigenous individuals and Native American tribes or tribal nations really assert their sovereignty and their agency to try and carve out what Kevin Brunel, as a scholar, would call it the third space of sovereignty, right? Because the U.S. doesn't recognize tribal nations or Native nations as foreign nations with independence in their own right. And yet it does have this recognition policy that recognizes Native nations as inherent sovereigns, and yet there's also this piece of incorporating or domesticating, so to speak, Native peoples and Indigenous peoples throughout the U.S. So you've got this really complicated history. And so I think for people who are invested in electoral politics and thinking about the Democratic Party, I mean, this is a huge win, right? But understanding it in relation to the structures of electoral politics and the limits of those. And also just thinking about the visibility of Native peoples in this country, I think that's huge. I think the fact that they're both women, and it's my understanding that one is also an out lesbian, I think this is all really important. And I also think that it's a way to also show light or shed light on the limits of even within the U.S. system. So one example I use in the classroom is the fact that the Bureau of Indian Affairs used to be under what was called the Department of War at the time, now known as the Department of Defense. You know, eventually once the Department of the Interior was created to hold the national parks and services and deal with the island territories in the Caribbean and the Pacific, territories being a polite word of colonies, you have the Bureau of Indian Affairs falling under the Department of Interior. And yet, why isn't there a Department of Indian Affairs, right? Why is it an office underneath the Department of the Interior? And you can see that language of interiority has to do with the resonances around domestication, right? And so there's different ways that we can, I think, be attentive to this as a political gain on the one hand, understanding its limits while still celebrating, but also really always pointing to the structural limitations so that we can, again, do the work of anti-normalization to challenge U.S. settler colonialism and certainly U.S. imperialism the world over.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. So much more to talk about, but I hope our audience picks up a copy of your new book. Good luck to you, and thank you so much.
Mahalo. Aloha, everybody. Thank you.
My guest is Jay Kehalani Kawanui, Professor of American Studies and Anthropology, Director of the Center for the Americas and Chair of the American Studies Department at Wesleyan University. We've been discussing the new book she has just edited called Speaking of Indigenous Politics, Conversations with Activists, Scholars, and Tribal Leaders. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.